To my right is the Honorable Alan Loeb, and to my left is the Honorable Nancy Lichtenstein. We constitute Division 6 for our arguments this afternoon arising out of one case. And I will call that, for quickness's sake, Heiner versus Johnson. We would like to have oral argument first on what I'm going to call the trial case. That's 10CA1069. And then we would like to have oral argument second out of what I shall call the writ of attachment case, 10CA1846. The division has talked, and we have decided that we are going to ask both sides for supplemental briefing on the writ of attachment case. I want to make clear that this is not any sort of signal what we intend about what we may or may not wish to do on either case, and certainly not an indication that we are going to rule one way or the other in the trial case, but we would like to have briefs to assist us in our analysis. And that has to do with the following issue. The issue is whether Colorado Rule of Civil Procedure 102A applies to the circumstances here where a writ of attachment was used in an effort to obtain costs and fees. We would like those briefs to be no more than 7 pages. We would like them to be simultaneous, and we would like them to be submitted within 5 working days of today's hearing. That being said, I'll proceed to a couple of very quick, regular housekeeping matters. Counsel, are you all familiar with this court's procedures?
Yes, Your Honor.
Do you have any questions about those procedures, either side? All right. Last, before I begin the argument, I would ask that anyone in the courtroom who has a cellular phone or a pager or another type of electronic device that might go off during argument and interrupt counsel's arguments, if you would either turn those off or turn them to silent, we would greatly appreciate it. With that being said, let us go to Heiner versus Johnson, the trial case, 10CA1069.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. My name is Gary Craw. Mrs. Heiner went to Parkview Hospital for an elective surgery on her parathyroid glands. She was given general anesthesia, but never regained her preoperative level of consciousness. She came out of anesthesia confused and physically agitated. The records are clear that she was incoherent, unable to communicate, physically flailing and kicking about, which was demonstrated in the courtroom and which was uncontrollable. In the PACU, as it's called, post-anesthesia care unit, or I call it sometimes the recovery room, Dr. Johnson had Mrs. Heiner put in 4-point restraints because she was a danger to herself and others in this condition. Dr. Rickman, the anesthesiologist's diagnosis, was that this was just a benign reaction to some blue dye that was given to the patient before and for use in the surgery. Doctors Johnson and Rickman discharged Mrs. Heiner from PACU to a general nursing floor, and for the next 16 hours, Your Honors, Mrs. Heiner was incoherent, kicking and flailing wildly and uncontrollably, unable to communicate, and tied down in 4-point restraints. That continued for 16 hours until her temperature reached 108 to 109 degrees. Then the defendants transferred her to the ICU. The ICU quickly diagnosed her as suffering from a condition called serotonin syndrome, but it was too late. She died. The first issue is whether, in voir dire, where jurors 7 and 17 testified that they'd require proof to a 95% certainty before they would find doctors guilty of malpractice, whether it was error to deny a challenge for cause. Despite being told by the judge and counsel that the burden of proof that applied was more probably true than not. Now here, three of the best malpractice defense attorneys in this state had a chance to rehabilitate both jurors 7 and 17. They started down that road, they felt resistance, and they abandoned their efforts to rehabilitate those jurors.
Mr. Carr, I have a question about juror number 7. At one point when defense counsel asked this juror, but once you internally decide the issue in your mind, you will apply the court's decision to say that proof has to be more likely than not. And the juror responded, uh-huh. And I want you to address the significance of that response.
Your Honor, I think that that is not significant rehabilitation when the juror has specifically stated that they would require proof to a 95% certainty. I mean, it's very vague and ambiguous, and frankly, what juror in their right mind would say no to that question, that they're not going to follow the judge's rules?
Yes, a follow-up question to that. What do you do with respect to Colorado cases that say when jurors give what are seemingly inconsistent answers to different questions, it's within the full discretion of the trial court to figure out which one he thinks either makes or disqualifies the juror as a potential juror?
Well, discretion only goes so far. Here, if I can point to the record, Your Honor, I asked this question. What if the judge were to instruct you that more probably than not means 51% or more, and the law requires you to find or decide? That's on the side that gives you 51% or more. How do you feel about that? The juror then said, and we're talking about juror one here, it depends on the case. And then I said, and I think someone else raised their hand in the back, Mr. Vigil, what would be the minimum percentage of certainty you would require to make a decision for or against the doctors in this case? 95%? Juror 11, 95%. Okay. Then I asked, 95%, and how many of you feel the same as Mr. Vigil? They would require 95% to go against doctors in this case. We have Mr. Blazing and Mr. Antonveros, who I believe then are jurors 7 and 17. And for instance, juror 7 said, I think if someone is going to be proven guilty, then it should be more than just 51%. That's my opinion. Then I asked, so would you have trouble following that instruction of the judge? Yes. Could you be frank with me? Could you follow that instruction? Would you be inclined to do so? And the juror says, after a phrase I'm leaving out for time purposes, I couldn't do it. I would have to be proven to say that they were guilty. I asked, to what level? Like I said, 95% or so. When you have that strong a resistance, Your Honor, to the burden of proof, I don't think this is inconsistent with prior case law. I think it's an abuse of discretion to deny the challenge for cause.
Pardon me for interrupting.
Yes, Your Honor.
Do I understand correctly that neither juror 7 nor 17 sat on the jury? They were both removed by peremptory challenges?
That is correct.
Thank you.
The defendants were not even able to rehabilitate these jurors to 70% or a 60% certainty. Here, the court should find on this record that it was error not to grant the challenge for cause. When jurors are told that the burden of proof is more probably true than not, but they say they'll require a 95% certainty or more to find against doctors. The next issue I'd like to address is the trial judge's striking of Exhibit 12, as well as testimony of defense or plaintiff's expert anesthesiologist, Dr. Pearson. The trial judge struck the exhibit and the testimony of Dr. Pearson, claiming there was insufficient foundation to establish that the discharge criteria at Parkview Hospital applied to both nurses and doctors. The key point, and it's undisputed in the record, is that only a doctor can discharge a patient from the recovery room. We proved sufficient foundation in these three ways. Mrs. Dennis, the chief nursing officer of the hospital, testified that a doctor's order is required before a patient can be discharged from the recovery room. Dr. Pearson, an expert in anesthesia from the University of Iowa, testified that based on his experience and long time in teaching anesthesia residents, practiced for more than 20 years in that area, that in his experience, only doctors could discharge a patient from the anesthesia room, or rather the post-anesthesia room. Therefore, the rule applied equally to doctors.
Over that, let me explore that a little bit. I'm not sure, maybe it's contested, but I'm not sure anybody's contesting that a doctor had to be the final one to do the discharge, but does that then necessarily equate to the fact that the policy set forth in Exhibit 12 had anything to do with doctors as opposed to nurses?
Well, it does when you look at the exhibit, and it's Exhibit 12, Your Honor. It's the Parkview Medical Center patient discharge from PACU. In the briefs of my opponents, I noticed they wrote that it says on its face that it only applies to nurses. Please review it. It does not. If you look at it carefully, what it says is all patients who have received general anesthesia may be discharged when meeting the pertinent discharge criteria, and with an order from an anesthesiologist, which further confirms my first point. And one of the discharge criteria, number four, says the patient must be returned to the pre-anesthetic level of consciousness and oriented to person, place, and time. Number six says that before discharge, the patient must have movement of all their extremities at pre-anesthesia levels. Here the record is clear, and there can be no doubt that Mrs. Heiner didn't meet either of those criteria when she was jointly discharged by Dr. Rickman, the anesthesiologist, with the approval of the attending surgeon, Dr. Johnson.
Is there any testimony in the record from anybody that the policies in Exhibit 12 specifically applied to doctors?
I believe the stricken testimony of Dr. Pearson said that. It was a general standard among anesthesiologists. As you know, the standard of care is national. It's not different in Iowa than it is here. But that was stricken by the trial judge. I think it's important to point out that Dr. Johnson is complicit in his discharge from the recovery room in this condition. He was aware of her condition, and that's shown in the record, Exhibit 1, on page 134, it says Dr. Johnson in at 4:11. The discharge from PACU was at 4:40. The patient was placed in restraints by order, this is Exhibit 1, page 24, by order of Dr. Johnson at 4:40 on the same date, because she was a danger and a risk of harm to herself and others. And then when she arrived in the general nursing room at 16:40, the first note written by the nurse that received her said, patient uncooperative, combative, extremely disoriented, does not follow commands, complaints applied, the family is upset and distraught, calls in to Dr. Johnson and Rickman, pupils fixed and dilated, extremities shaking and patient flailing them around, turning head side to side, sticking tongue out. Family states this is not the patient's norm. Your Honor, it was clearly below the standard of care for Drs. Johnson and Rickman to discharge Mrs. Heiner from the PACU to the general nursing floor under those circumstances. I'd like to reserve what time I have left.
Certainly, counsel, you have 3.5 minutes. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Todd Drake. I represent the appellees, Dr. Johnson and Dr. King. I will be handling the oral argument on behalf of all appellees in the case. Your Honors, Mr. Craw started talking about how this is a sad case and tragic case, and we don't dispute that. This was a very sad case, and no one would disagree with that. It involved a very rare and at the time unknown complication of this procedure. Now, the fact that it was a sad case, an emotional case, does not change the fact that this was a good trial. It was a fair trial. The district court was presented with a number of legal issues that it addressed thoroughly, comprehensively, made appropriate records, and in no way abused its discretion. Mr. Craw, in his brief, has raised four separate issues. It's important to note, as Judge Lopez, as you already pointed out, all four of those issues are subject, the standard review is abuse of discretion. Simply put, did this trial court do something that was so manifestly wrong that precluded a fair trial for the plaintiff in this case? And the answer is no. In addition, Your Honors, three of those four issues raised by plaintiff, by appellant, resulted at most in harmless error, at least as it relates to Dr. Johnson and Dr. King. Two of those four are harmless errors relates to Dr. Rickman. So there is no argument that that would have changed the result of the verdict in any way, including the first issue, this issue of the hospital policy, the nursing policy that Mr. Craw argues was improperly stricken by the trial court.
Let me interrupt just on that for a little bit. On the jury issue, the juror for cause issue,
yes.
Are you saying that's subject to harmless error? And if so what authority do you have for that?
That issue is not the one that I'm arguing harmless error on, Your Honor. It's the other three issues. We would agree that the fact that plaintiff was required to use his peremptory challenges is a basis for him to challenge that court's ruling denying the striking the jurors for cause. I'm happy to talk about that. In terms of the exhibit 12 and the nursing policy, Judge Loeb, going back to your point, and the key question this is, was there any testimony, any evidence that that policy related to the physicians in this case? Because the plaintiff's argument in the trial court was that it was somehow standard of care for the physicians. That's why he wanted to introduce it. And the answer is no. There, in fact, the exact opposite is true. Mr. Craw indicated that one of the ways he tried to establish foundation was through the testimony of Ms. Dennis, the director of nursing at Parkview Hospital. You know, as Ms. Dennis, in her testimony, and that's in the transcript from February 10th and at page 143, makes it abundantly clear these policies apply to nurses. She was specifically asked by Mr. Craw, so these are policies that apply to nurses and physicians, and she said no, they apply to nurses. She acknowledged that hospitals do not dictate care to physicians. The physicians exercise their independent judgment, that those policies are simply there for purposes of the nursing. And again, as you point out, Judge Loeb, it's not, we don't dispute that physicians ultimately make the decision on discharge. That's not the question here. The question is, in making that decision, are they in any way bound by this policy, by this hospital policy? And they're not. Not only did Ms. Dennis testify to that, but one of the post-anesthesia care unit nurses, Renee Wolcher, testified the exact same thing. She's a nurse who works with those policies every day, and she said, these policies apply to me. They apply to the nurses within the PACU, not to the physicians.
Could you clarify for me, because I believe Mr. Craw had indicated that the court had stricken testimony that suggested the policy applied to doctors, and
Your Honor, the testimony that was stricken by Dr. Pearson, I believe, was that the opinions that he had that the physician, specifically Dr. Rickman, had somehow violated this policy, or excuse me, had violated the standard of care by not following this policy, that's what was stricken. There was no testimony from Dr. Pearson indicating that this policy applied specifically. Dr. Pearson didn't know whether this policy applied. He didn't have the foundational knowledge to say whether or not this policy at Parkview Hospital applied to physicians. Mr. Cross indicated to the court he would try and tie it up, because the way this came about was with Dr. Pearson, when he wanted to introduce it, the trial court essentially conditionally admitted that exhibit and said, I will allow you to question him about this exhibit if you can connect it up later with foundational testimony. Mr. Cross said he would, and the judge warned him at that time that if he did not tie it up, he would strike that exhibit, he would strike Dr. Pearson's testimony. That's exactly what happened. Mr. Craw tried to get additional expert testimony on that through, he at least indicated he was going to do that through Dr. Rickman himself, and then asked him no questions about the exhibit. As he acknowledges, there is no foundational basis within this record, nothing presented to the trial court upon which you can say that this policy, Exhibit 12, applied to physicians. In fact, the evidence is clear that it's the opposite. And we would submit, had the judge not stricken this exhibit, it would have been here, because the jury had already heard evidence about it and suggestions that it somehow applied to physicians without the foundational testimony. Going to Mr. Cross first issue, the challenges for cause of the two jurors, juror 7 and 17. Judge Loeb, you're absolutely right. This is a strong, there's a long line of cases that this is an abuse of discretion standard, particularly whereas here, as you've noted, this is a situation where you had jurors giving, at least on the record, appear to be somewhat conflicting answers at times. As this court is aware, you can't review one isolated comment by the juror and say, based on that one isolated comment, that's enough. You need to look at this voir dire as a whole. And looking at it as a whole, it's important to note that this whole concept of 95% of these percentages came about through the questioning by plaintiff's counsel. Mr. Craw was the one who suggested percentages. He started out by asking the jurors, so he said, we have this system in which I have to prove my case more probably than not. And a lot of people think that's unfair. Who here thinks that's unfair? And several jurors raised their hands, and he said, what percentage would you want? Would you want 60%, 70%, 80%? And that's how this started, this whole process of the discussion of the 95%.
Well, what does it matter how it started? Let's take juror 7. I mean, sure. He says a number of times, it's 95%. At one point, I mean, he says something like, you know, if I can internally decide that it meets my own criteria of 95%, then sure, I'll follow the judge's instructions. But, I mean, to say that at that point, isn't that kind of a non sequitur? Once he's decided it's 95%, he's surely going to decide it's 51%. So, I mean, I'm playing the devil's advocate here. Why are those inconsistent?
The reason that I believe, and to be fair, I agree, I don't think that's inconsistent. What he did, though, was he clarified what he meant by that 95%. It goes back, the reason why I raised that was brought up by Mr. Craw, it goes back to his initial question to these jurors was, in making an important decision, what percentage of certainty do you want? That's the context in which they were answering 95%. He was then asked, and this part of the rehabilitation that Mr. Craw claims is necessary, he was asked by defense counsel, when you're talking about that 95%, do you mean in looking at evidence you want some certainty in your mind? And he said, yes, that's what I mean. He was then asked specifically, as you point out, Judge Lichtenstein, he was specifically asked, regardless of what you want in your mind, will you apply the court's instruction of law that on the burden of proof, it is more probable than not? And he answered, yes. He answered, uh-huh. And it was even followed up by defense counsel saying, so what you're saying is that you will follow the court's instruction on burden of proof. You will not hold the plaintiff to more than 50%. And there was no negation of that by the juror.
Well, I'm just looking at the record, and it looks like that the juror said, I don't know. I'm still kind of, they have got to really convince me, in other words. And so, you know, I'm looking here, and I don't see that the juror unequivocally stated, yes, I will follow the court's instructions on this point.
Judge Lewis, I believe that excerpt comes from an earlier time during Mr. Craw's questioning, and would you follow this instruction? And I agree, at that point he said, you know, it was clear that he had some misgiving about the concept of more probable than not. He said in his mind, boy, and the way he explained it was, if I were a plaintiff in a case, I would sure, before I came into this court, I would want to know with more than 51% certainty. The specific question he was asked was, if you had that 51 or 50 line, how would you do? And he said, boy, I'd really like to have more. What he was not asked was, are you saying that you won't follow the court's instruction? Mr. Craw didn't ask him that. Defense counsel asked him, will you follow the court's instruction? He said, yes. In fact, he said it twice. He said it early during the voir dire process. Yes, I will follow all the court's instructions. At no time did plaintiff's counsel demonstrate any actual bias on the part of their juror 7 or juror 17, and that's required. He demonstrated no equanimity towards plaintiffs. In fact, both of these jurors at another point in the voir dire said if they were a plaintiff, they would want them as jurors on the case. So I think the suggestion that this somehow demonstrated actual bias because of some confusion over this 95%, I think looking at the voir dire as a whole, the trial court properly exercised its discretion. There is no demonstration of abuse of discretion. There's no indication anywhere in the record that either of those jurors would not follow the court's instructions. In terms of the other two issues, I know they have been raised by Mr. Kraw. Quickly, I'd like to deal with the fourth issue raised by him, however, this substantial factor causation. Again, this the standard review on this is abuse of discretion. Mr. Kraw's argument trial was based on a 1985 case, the Sharp versus Kaiser case out of the Court of Appeals. That case has sat out there since that time, and in that case, there was some discussion about if a defendant is a substantial factor in contributing to a plaintiff's injury, that might be sufficient to establish causation. As this court's aware, we submitted supplemental authority. The Riegel case, another division, another panel of this court 2 months ago, ruled that that holding is inconsistent with Colorado Supreme Court, the precedent through the Colorado Supreme Court on that. What the court in Riegel made clear was that but-for causation remains the law in Colorado and has been the law in Colorado for as long as we've had tort cases. In fact, there's the argument that substantial factor causation has ever been applied is wrong. The Supreme Court within the Sharp versus Kaiser case, when they reviewed the case, while they said we are not looking at this issue of substantial factor causation, they later said to prove causation in a negligence case, the plaintiff must show that the injury would not have occurred but for the defendant's negligence, for the defendant's negligent conduct. They made it clear, but for causation is still the test. And I don't know whether that has been abandoned. I assume it's not been abandoned, but I believe while this court is not bound by the panel's decision in Riegel, I think it's an excellent discussion of that concept. They looked at federal law on that, and it's clear that throughout that time, since Sharp was decided in 1985, there has been no change from Colorado law that remains but for causation. That is one of the issues as well, Your Honors, that is clearly harmless here. The jury found no negligence by any of these physicians. Without any finding of negligence, there can be no causation. Causation is, was there some negligence that caused the plaintiff's injury? There's no negligence. It really doesn't matter what they find on causation. Once they've found no negligence, that ends their inquiry. The last issue raised was this evidence of non-parties. As the mayor, in a review of the record, makes it very clear that there never was any discussion of non-parties. Plaintiff cites to two excerpts, two questions of witnesses related to essentially the care in the ICU, the timing of when Mrs. Heiner was taken back to the ICU, and also issues of treatment that was applied in the ICU, the ice baths, fans. In each of those questions, and looking at the record, Your Honor, and this can be found at the transcript on February 24th, page 106 to 108, and February 25th at page 137 to 138, neither the questions nor the answers discuss any specific party. There's no reference to anyone or any entity in those questions. The question is not, do you think the nurses should have done something different? Do you think that the critical care specialist, Dr. Janosik, should have done something different? But there simply is no discussion at all of third parties. And so based on that, there was no basis for this curative instruction submitted by plaintiffs that went to, you should not consider fault or negligence of some other party. It would have only served to confuse the jury. This is another one, Your Honors, where, again, we submit this would be harmless error anyway. The jury found no negligence on the part of the defendants. Any issue of non-party negligence would have only been used to allocate between, once they found negligence on the part of the defendants, to allocate in terms of that fault. So, see, I'm running short on time. Happy to answer any additional questions the court may have. Thank you, Raza. I believe, based on this record, as I said, I believe it was a fair trial, it's an appropriate trial, and we therefore ask that this court affirm the verdict and judgment in favor of the appellees. Thank you.
Counsel? withdraw this next three minutes and 30 seconds is yours to do with as you wish. However, if you would be so kind as to address what your position is on the applicability of Rigel versus Save a Senior Care, I'd appreciate it.
Okay. I'll just be very brief on that.
Certainly.
First, that issue only applies if you reverse. If you don't reverse, we don't reach it. I agree that it's, if there's no negligence, you don't have to look at the question of causation. But I think Rigel creates an inconsistency in the Court of Appeals between two panels on whether or not this, I think it's subsection 431 of the Restatement Second of Torts on substantial factor causation applies or not. The court there did seem to say, the Supreme Court rejected the idea of substantial causation in the Kaiser versus Sharp, Court of Appeals, Supreme Court decision of that. But I point you to that decision at page 718. This is the Supreme Court. It says, quote, we express no opinion on whether we would apply section 323A of the restatement. I misquoted it earlier. In a proper case. They just found that in that case, there was sufficient but-for causation that they didn't need to address whether or not the section 323A substantial factor causation was required. Your Honor, I think counsel misstated my position, and I'd like to make it clear to you if I can on Exhibit 12, the stricken discharge criteria from the recovery room. I'm not saying that that was the absolute standard of care. What I'm saying is that was some relevant evidence of what the standard of care is. And that was probative. There was, and it was excluded for no good reason after there had been sufficient foundation to show that a doctor has to approve a discharge. And if you look at it, it really doesn't make much sense. Why would you, if that was only for nurses, why, who cannot discharge a patient from the recovery room, why would you put in criteria like that if you didn't want that to at least have some influence on your doctors? So my position is that was some relevant evidence on the standard of care. Dr. Pearson's stricken testimony said it was the standard of care, and the judge wrongly excluded both of those. As to the percentage thing in jury selection, when I've done that in other cases, I've had most of the time the trial judge intervene and say to the juror, look, I want you to understand that a plaintiff only has to prove their case by more probably true than not evidence. That means 51% or more of the credible evidence. Are you able to follow that rule? Here the judge didn't do that. I would propose that the rule that should apply to a case like this is where there are any doubts that are expressed about the ability to follow a specific and critical rule of law, the burden of proof, that sufficient rehabilitation has not been shown unless the juror is asked specifically about that point of law and is rehabilitated.
Except, do you have any law in Colorado that says that's what the rule is? I know that you'd like it to be that, but I'm not aware of any case that says that's what the law is.
I am not either, and I admit that. But if you think about it, the general question, will you follow the judge's instructions? Well, who besides a nut or a rude person would say no to that? It's ambiguous, it's unclear, it's not focusing in on where the juror has admitted, I've got some real problem with this, I can't really follow that 51% rule. So that's why I think that should be the rule. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Craw. Your time for this argument is over. Thank you, counsel, for your arguments on this case. The case stands submitted.